welcome to the Coaching and Therapy channel. So this channel is quite close to my heart because I train coaches in embodiment. I mean, why? Because if you don't work with the body, you're missing a lot. Whether you're a coach, a therapist, facilitator, whatever, that's how you go deep quickly. That's how you do stuff that's sticky. We have to take the body into account. This channel is sponsored by Dylan Newcombe and Uzazu Embodied Intelligence. Dylan is a genius, quite simply put, and I wouldn't say that about many people in this field. I've been studying with Dylan for, God, the first time was probably 10 years ago in the Netherlands. He speaks fluent Dutch, by the way, as well as Korean and a few other languages. What I love about Dylan is his ability to make models of things, looking at how embodiment works. His system, Uzazu, U-Z-A-Z-U, is really all about state shifting. So I think of him as the sort of master of state changing, how we can shift our state, our client's state, and how we can develop ourselves through those different ways of being. So I think for coaches and therapists, it's like easy to learn, practical toolkit. I've used it myself over the years. So if you want a 3-day online training with Dylan, then look at the link below, or you can go to Uzazu, uzazu.org. And even easier, he's got an embodied assessment there you can do as well. We all love doing these little tests about ourselves, but this is an embodied one. So there you go. Welcome to the Coaching and Therapy channel. I'm going to be on this one a lot just because there's lots of cool people on here. Lots of people, I think, you know, well worth a listen. Embodiment in facilitation is so necessary. So from me to you, welcome.
Great. And welcome to the channel. And those of you that are joining us today, welcome to this great workshop that will be with the focus on mental fitness continuum is the name of the workshop. The most important thing you will ever do, question mark or dot dot. And this is being offered by Jimmy Hunt, sorry, I just lost my, Jimmy Hunt from New Zealand. In reading some of your bio, Jimmy, I noticed you have a very colourful and diverse background that includes being the co-founder of a charity called Live More Awesome. It's a pretty neat charity name. And you're also well known, and I've watched a couple of them for your TED Talks, that have highlighted your unique and colourful way of reducing stigma around mental health. Apart from your charity and TED Talks, your unique and successful efforts at raising awareness has been featured in a major US network documentary. So that must be very gratifying to hear that your efforts are really out there. I probably won't mention to everyone your worldwide fame in the Guinness Book of Records. We might leave that till later. I'll just hold that thought. But look forward to you sharing your workshop. And thanks so much, Jimmy, for being here.
Thanks for having me. All right. Hello, everybody. Thanks for coming along. We start off just a little bit intense. I'm sorry about that, but it's going to be a bit of an intense start. So you ready? Well, I'd ask if you're ready, but you can't even tell me. So I suspect you're ready. All right, let's go. By the year 2025, over 80% of the people on this planet will suffer from a mental health condition in their lifetime. In the last decade, antidepressant medication has risen about 83% and suicide is up 50%. Every second, a person takes their own life. Over 40% of employers do not feel responsible for the well-being of their staff. Depression is the leading cause of disability in the world. On top of the lives, it costs us billions of dollars in lost revenue. We're on a big, lubed-up water slide, sliding very quickly towards a spiky pit at the bottom. Everything is pretty fucked. Whew. Online. It's a pretty intense way to start a presentation. I like dogs. These are two of my favorite dogs. They cheer me up.
Jimmy, not to interrupt you, I'm so sorry. Your slides are showing up in the corner and we're seeing the show notes on the main screen there.
Oh, that's annoying.
I figured I'd give you a heads up.
Yeah, give me a heads up. That's why I hate doing all my stuff.
Technology, it's a blessing and a curse.
Yeah, it is.
That's it. We can all hum a song, Justin. Hum you into smooth transition to slides.
Let's try this again. Share the screen. Share the presentation. Hopefully you can see that. Can someone tell me if they can see that shared screen?
Yes.
Yep, we can see the shared screen.
Okay. And full screen.
I'm sorry?
And in full screen too. Oh, no, you've got a small...
It was, and then it just disappeared again. There it is.
All right. It's because this is Zoom webinar. It acts differently to Zoom meetings. And it means that I can't see my notes. So I will fix that. My backup plan. That's my backup plan right there. All right, so hopefully you can see all of this. We can see it. We're kind of good. We kind of know what's going on.
We're good.
Good.
Yeah, full screen.
I can't see my next slide, so I'm just going to make all this up as I go along. Right. So, the mood in the room was gone. I was cheering myself up with dogs. Then I was cheering myself up with weird things. Hopefully that cheers you up too. And then there's this. Who cares? What it comes back to, basically, is that by the year 2025, 80% of the people of this planet will suffer from a mental health condition in their lifetime. We're in trouble as a society and as individuals. But here's one thing I really want you to understand. It's not your fault. You are not broken, but society is. Society is basically set up for you to fail because we were never taught as children how to deal with our thoughts, our feelings, our behaviors, our relationships, and our traumas. School never taught us those things. Work never teaches those things. We just have to learn them on our own, and most of us don't get to do that. It's set up to fail, and we are failing in record numbers. And look, if you really want to understand, I mean, like I said, you know, everything is pretty fucked. And it's not just my opinion that is backed up by countless studies and facts and all sorts of stuff. But I highly recommend you check out Johan Hari's book, Lost Connections. It's a brilliant summed up narration of where we're at as a society and things that we can do to move ourselves out of that. But here's the crazy thing. Mental illness is not necessarily a bad thing. In fact, yeah, that's why I can't see the rest of my slides. Mental illness isn't necessarily a bad thing. Just quickly, I want to define mental illness. Mental illness, about 100% of mental illness, about 93% of mental illness is made up of what is called lifestyle-based mood disorders, your stress, your anxiety, your depression, your PTSD, things like that. The other 7% are neurodiverse things like schizophrenia, OCD, bipolar, Tourette's, things like that. And what I'm here talking about is the 93% of mental illnesses are not necessarily a bad thing. In fact, mine was the best thing that ever happened to me. Don't get me wrong, it almost killed me, but it's actually the best thing that ever happened to me because it put me in enough severe discomfort in order to actually change. Now, psychologists have a word for that. It's called post-traumatic growth. And basically what that means, put in enough trouble, you're forced to make change and get better, and you grow from it. And now I'm a good example of that. I think my wife is a perfect example of that. She grew up in basically what can be considered a small cult. She was subjected to mental, physical, emotional, and sexual abuse. She ended up getting out of that eventually, married a man who wasn't much better, got out of that, and then ended up with me. So hopefully that was a step up. And then because she was in a safe place, she ended up getting what they termed post-traumatic stress-induced chronic fatigue, where she couldn't get out of bed for 23 and a half hours a day for over a year. After that, she ended up working on herself and becoming one of the most beautiful, loving, caring, compassionate people I know. Now, question is, were we just lucky? No, we weren't just lucky. Both of us did the work, and that's what I want to talk to you about today. Now, so the question is, you know, what is that work? Well, basically the mental fitness continuum. This is what I sort of decided was the way that I needed to understand how it worked, because you see, we treat mental illness like an on-off switch. You've either got it or you don't. You're either mentally well or you're mentally ill. But I realize there's a lot more to it than that. You see, the way we've treated depression for the last, you know, 30, 40 years is basically wrong. We treat it like it's a disease. And it's not a disease. It's not something that you're born with. It's not something that you catch. It is a symptom of a life lived, a life with trials, tribulations, and traumas. Now, why is it called the mental fitness continuum? Because the term mental health is a bit broken. Like I said, it's either mentally ill or mentally well, but mental health has started moving to be synonymous with mental illness. When I say Mental Health Awareness Week, people think Mental Illness Awareness Week. And here in New Zealand, twice recently on the national news, I have seen the anchors say that a person suffered from mental health. The term's a bit broken. Look, when you put it in that context, you can see what our job is, what we want to be doing. We want to be moving ourselves up the mental fitness continuum. So how do we do that? Well, very simply, externally, there are some simple and scientifically proven ways to do that. One is connection. Being connected with friends, family, close people is very important. So is having community, having something to belong to that's bigger than yourself. It's also really good to have your physical fitness, obviously. So it's also good to have goals, something to work towards. You should also have an ikigai. No, not the creepy guy at the work Christmas party. An ikigai is the Japanese term for reason to get up in the morning. Now, all of these things are mental fitness tools that I put in my mental fitness toolbox. They're just some of them. You can obviously have there's all sorts of tools that you can have in there. But the idea is to have as many tools as possible to put in that toolbox so that you have the right tool to deal with any of the things that will come along in your life, which they inevitably will. I'll give you an example. My friend, she, very successful businesswoman, she has a wonderful family, and she was playing indoor netball. She landed poorly. She tore her Achilles tendon. Now, that's a horrific injury at the best of times. It takes about 6 months to get better from. And while she was getting better, physically, her mental fitness went off a cliff. Why? Well, quite simply, she only had one tool in her mental fitness toolbox: physical exercise. She thought she had like 8 tools in her toolbox. She thought she had running and the gym and walking with her friends and indoor netball, but she really only had one: physical fitness. And you take that away and she had nothing left to fill in the gaps. And so it's a very simple question I ask you now. How many tools do you have in your mental fitness toolbox? What happens if one of the major ones breaks? You know, do you have enough other things to be able to pull in? If not, maybe need to go and find some. Now, your mental fitness toolkit is more important than, you know, factual knowledge, money, relationships, intelligence, because without being mentally fit, all of those other things will end up failing you. Like all the stuff I just spoke about, all those external things, they're really good. You should collect as many of those as possible to put in your toolbox, help you move yourself up the continuum. But what I'm really interested in is the internal things, and they are the most important, your thoughts, your feelings, and your behaviors. You see, I was in severe discomfort and I'd been there for a long time and I needed to change. I needed to get myself out of there. So I put some external things in place to help move me up the mental fitness continuum. I prioritize my physical fitness, my sense of adventure, and I put goals in place in order to achieve. And so I did what most people do. When you want to put those things in place, I decided to lilo the Waikato River. Now, for international people, a lilo is a New Zealand product, which is like a pool float, basically. That thing in the bottom right-hand corner, it's like a single mattress that you put in a pool. That's a lilo. And the Waikato, that is the longest river in New Zealand, 425 kilometers long. That was what I decided to do. Now, Lilo the Waco is a long story, but the cliff notes real quick. Basically, it took me 11 days to swim the river, swimming 10 to 14 hours each day. Now, I'd been down the bottom end of the mental fitness continuum for a while, and I was basically broke. I hadn't been able to work very much. And so this adventure had some costs to it that I couldn't quite cover. And so one was accommodation. I needed somewhere to stay each night, and the other was food. And so I came up with a very simple solution, which was each night I would get out of the river and I would go up to the nearest house and I'd knock on the door and I'd say, "Hi, my name is Jimmy. I just happened to be liloing your river out here. Would you mind if I stayed the night and had some food?" Now, for a person with depression and anxiety, that is one of the scariest things you could possibly do. And I'm not going to lie, I probably spent, you know, like half an hour each night sitting on the banks of the river, scanning the riverbanks, trying to figure out which house looked the kindest. When I finally got up the courage, I figured that, you know, to find 10 houses to let me stay over the 10 nights, I'd probably have to knock on about 100 doors. And in the end, I had to knock on a grand total of 10 doors. Every single person opened the door, listened to what I had to say, and said, "Sure, please come on in. This is what we're having for dinner. Then this is where you're gonna stay tonight. And I wake up in the morning and they'll be like, "Here's some breakfast. Would you like me to pack your lunch?" "Yes, please. I would." And I guess that was the simplest thing that I learned from that whole adventure, is that when you ask for help openly, honestly, and genuinely, you get it. People come out of the woodwork and they're happy to help. In fact, people are waiting out there to be able to help because it makes them feel good. They want to actually help. And I can see you all sitting there thinking, "Hey, maybe I should lilo a river." Don't. It's stupid. I didn't do any research. I didn't know there were grade 4 rapids on the river. That was bad on my part. I didn't quite realize I'd have to swim 10 to 14 hours every day either. That was a bit of a problem. But at the end, I managed to make it to the end, and it was very successful. It all went really well. But one of the surprising things to me was that about 1,500 people bothered to find my email address. They bothered to send me an email and said things like, Jimmy, you inspired me to go on an adventure. You inspired me to work it out with my partner. You inspired me to work on my mental health. And I was like, wow. I didn't do it for you. I didn't do it for you at all. I did this 100% for me. I had no idea that sharing my story openly and honestly would resonate with anyone or connect. And the number one thing I heard in return was me too, which made me realize for the first time, because I was pretty sure, I was quite confident that I was the only person in the world who was depressed, anxious, and suicidal. Pretty sure I was. Turned out I wasn't. And that was one of the nicest things to find out. And after that, people were like, what next? You know, Lilo the Amazon? No, I'm not going to Lilo the Amazon. I said, but I do have another idea. I do have an idea. And so I told them I'm going to build the world's biggest water slide. And they're like, okay. And so I said, look, internet, please give me $120,000. And the internet said, okay, and gave it to me 4 days later. And so I built the biggest water slide in the world. It is 601.98 meters long. I did it at a place called Jonkers Farm on the west coast of New Zealand. Then a guy rang me up and he said, hello, I'm a billionaire. Please bring it to New Jersey on my ski field. And I said, okay. And I took it there and they gave me, Guinness did, the Guinness World Record for the biggest water slide in the goddamn world. And this, ladies and gentlemen, is what it looks like. It is 601.98 meters long. It is completely inflatable. And if you are my size, you can get up to about 55 Ks an hour, and it takes about a minute 10 to get to the bottom. If you are the 205 kilogram mascot of the local rugby team here, it takes you about 57 seconds and you get up to about 65 Ks an hour. And because it's completely inflatable, I can do things like put a jump in the middle of it. And I did this to raise money for my charity, Live More Awesome. And I also did it to raise awareness for mental health. And so basically what I was able to do is manipulate the media into talking to me about stuff that matters. And so I generated over about $20 million worth of media coverage in a year, including 9 minutes on the Today Show in the US. 7 of those minutes, I got to talk about mental health. And then that year, I wrote a best-selling book. I've opened TEDx Auckland to 2,500 people. I fronted a national ad campaign for the biggest company in our country. I was a finalist for New Zealand Innovator of the Year for the slide design. And I was a finalist for New Zealander of the Year for my work in mental health. I had a pretty fucking sweet year. Except I didn't. I hated that year. That year sucked. You see, the book didn't sell enough copies. The water slide didn't raise enough money. The TED Talk didn't get enough views. That product I fronted sucked and died. I did not win New Zealand Innovator of the Year, and I did not win New Zealander of the Year. I had a shit year. And that's when I realized I still had a problem. You see, I had been doing these things. I had been trying to move myself up the mental fitness continuum with these external things. And I'd sort of move myself back up for a minute or two, and then I'd slide right back down again. You see, it was because I was doing it for the extrinsic reasons, the doing it for the recognition, the achievements, and not for the opportunities for growth. I was doing it for what I wanted to achieve and not who I wanted to become. That's why I wasn't moving up. See, I've been trying to grow, trying to evolve, but it just wasn't working. And that frustration is common. But I think I've kind of figured out why. Well, Yeah, I kind of thought I figured out why. And basically what I needed was three prerequisites to change. And they are self-awareness, brutal honesty, and radical ownership. And so self-awareness is basically, at its core, the ability to see ourselves clearly, to understand who we are, how others see us, and how we fit into the world around us. Now, you look at that definition and you're like, yes, I can see myself clearly. I understand who I am, how others see me, and how I fit into the world around me. Hi, Jimmy Hunt. I'm self-aware. I see that. There's a woman called Tasha Urich. She did the biggest ever study done on self-awareness. She studied 6,500 people, and 95% of those people agreed with me that they were self-aware, according to that definition. And after her and her research team had studied them, she declared 10 to 12% of those people to actually be self-aware. And that's the cognitive dissonance between what we think we are and what we actually are. It's okay though. I'm self-aware. And to prove it, what I did was I went on her website, insightquiz.com, and I did her quiz. And so I filled it out, and at the end it says, please put in the email address of someone that knows you very well. So I put in my wife's email address, boom, off it goes, she answers it, goes back to Tasha, algorithm does its thing, I get a 6-page PDF, which lists all of the ways in which I am not self-aware. But she was wrong. I am self-aware. And so I went and redid the quiz. And at the end, I put my best friend's email address in there. Poof, off it went to her. She filled it out, came back. Algorithm sends me a 6-page PDF. Exactly the fucking same. Turns out I'm not very self-aware. And so there's two sides to that. One, I'm going to get angry and pissed off that I'm not self-aware. I can go, yay, absolutely, this is awesome, because I now have this massive opportunity for growth. And so here's the thing. There was a study done of college professors in the US. 95% of college professors in the US declared that they were above average at their job. That doesn't work. There's a study done of 13,500 engineers. 36% of them declared themselves to be in the top 5% of engineers. That also doesn't work out, does it? And there was just one lonely engineer who declared himself to be below average at his job. We're not very self-aware. Now, why is self-awareness so important? Well, simply, first up, you cannot change what you're not aware of. Real simple. And two, scientifically, it's one of the most effective ways to move yourself up the continuum. If you are self-aware, you are more likely to be creative, confident, you raise better children, you're healthier, you have better work outcomes, basically all of the things. And so in business, being self-aware is hugely important. Understanding how you fit into the work environment, how you fit in with your bosses and your peers and your employees is massively important. If you are an unaware senior executive, you are 600% more likely to derail the company. If you're an unaware senior executive in a Fortune 500 company in the US, you will cost them over $50 million per unaware executive. That's how important it is. Tasha calls it the meta skill of the 21st century. Look, self-awareness, real important, speaking all day. Just go read it from the smarter lady tonight. She'll tell you all about it. It's a very easy to read book with some really practical things in there and how to gain self-awareness, which is massively important. But intertwined with self-awareness is what we have is brutal honesty. Now, God damn, we are good at lying to ourselves. How you doing? I'm fine. Fuck you are. No, you're not. We lie to ourselves all day, every day. And so I lied to myself, you know, for years and years that I was okay. I was not. Now, my first piece of brutally honest self-awareness came from, I used to run a branding and design agency. Why my presentation looks so pretty. And it was lunchtime and I walked down to the front step and 15 minutes later, well, I walked down the front step because it was lunchtime and I had about 100 lunch options in downtown Auckland within about 500 meters of me. And 15 minutes later, I was still standing there bawling my eyes out because I couldn't figure out what I wanted to have for lunch. And so I went upstairs, I sat down, continued to cry and went, yep, you are officially batshit insane. You are crazy because you can't figure out what you want to have for lunch. And that was the first time that it dawned on me that I really had a problem. And that's internal self-awareness. And you can have internal self-awareness from you know, events or things, but the number one way we get internal self-awareness is sitting down and being quiet with ourselves. What other people call meditation. And I mean, there are a lot of meditation teachers on this channel, in this conference, and you should absolutely check them out. I think is the number one tool that you can put into your mental fitness toolbox. I mean, Tim Ferriss, famous podcast host and best-selling author, when he wrote his book, Tools of Titans, when he interviewed 150 of the most successful people on the planet, he said his number one personal takeaway was that over 90% of the people he interviewed had some sort of daily meditation practice and they credited it with their success. That's how important it is. And if you don't want to meditate, there's all sorts of mindfulness activities you can do as well. Maybe walking or running, going on a bike ride, knitting, whatever it is, just make sure you're not distracting yourself and you're sitting there and you're observing your thoughts. Now, there's internal self-awareness and then there's external self-awareness. External self-awareness can mainly come from what is called a loving critic. That is someone who you have a mutual level of respect for, someone who has your best interests at heart, and someone who is ready to be brutally honest with you. And I was with a mentor of mine one day and I wasn't ready or asking for some brutally honest external feedback, but she gave it to me. And she said, Jimmy, people love you. Like, okay, this is good. I'm liking this. She said, Jimmy, people love you despite you. Hold on. That hurt a little. Okay. And I knew as a loving critic, she was someone who was, you know, trying to be helpful to me. And so I had to really look into that. And I was like, yeah, people do love me because I'm a nice guy doing good things. They love me despite me. Okay. Maybe I'm a bit of a dick. Maybe my behavior is not good all the time. That was the first time I actually opened my eyes and went, yeah, you behave like a bit of a dick sometimes. Maybe you should look into that. Yes, I do. I had to sit down and get brutally honest with myself. And I wrote this list. And this list is about 9 years old now. It's hard to even still put up on the screen. But these are things that I just wanted to have answers to. Why do I do all of these things? And I was like, I really couldn't come up with an answer. And you see, that was part of the problem. I was like, why? Tasha in her research realized that why is the number one question that us humans use when trying to get internal self-awareness. She also found out that it was the least effective tool that we have in regards to us getting self-awareness. But here's the cool thing. There's a very, very simple reframe for this. And that is to change the whys to whats. You know, what am I feeling? What am I doing to move myself forward? What can I do to think differently in the future? See, the whys are a victim mentality. The whys keep us in the past, whereas the whats put us into a place of empowerment and help us move forward into the future. Now, the next thing I say is probably the most profound thing I say today. And I stole it from a quote on Instagram. Is your trauma probably isn't your fault, but your healing is 100% your responsibility. That is a harsh, brutal truth. And so much so I'll repeat it again. Your trauma probably isn't your fault. It's probably someone else's fault, some other thing's fault. It's probably not your fault. But your healing is 100% your responsibility and nobody else's. You're not even statistically likely to get an apology from the person or thing that caused you trauma, let alone have them heal it for you. It's 100% your responsibility. My wife cheated on me with a friend of ours. Then she got pregnant and we had to figure out whose it was, not mine. And it just left me on the couch absolutely broken. Now, why did that happen? Whose fault is it? Hers. It's her fault. Doesn't matter. Doesn't matter whose fault it was. It doesn't matter why it happened. It happened. You don't get to choose things that happen to you, but you do get to choose your response to them. And when I was sitting there crying on that couch, I remember having the first sort of understanding that I always had two choices. At any stage in my life, I always had two choices. And they were summed up very simply. They were either fear, all the decisions that surround that, or they were love. And I've been choosing fear over and over and over and over again for years. And this was the first time I remember consciously choosing love. And I'm not talking about some airy-fairy, Disney crazy bullshit kind of love. I'm talking about real practical love. And for me that day was to get up off the couch, to get out into the car, drive down to the supermarket, buy myself some healthy food, come home, cook it, eat it, wake up the next day, train for Lilo the Waikato. Did that fix all my problems? No. Following day, I had to choose love again and again and again and again and again. That's radical ownership. Now, you know, maybe it's in your business. Maybe your boss doesn't give you what you need to be able to do your job properly. And so you're just like, my boss is a dick, this company sucks. That may be the case. But it is 100% your responsibility to either convince, manipulate, educate, whatever you can, your boss to be able to give you what you need to be able to do your job to its full potential. Otherwise, you're going to make choices. Make choices to leave, you can make choices to do something else. But whatever it is, it's 100% your responsibility. And that's radical ownership. Right. Self-awareness, brutal honesty, radical ownership, are the three prerequisites to change. And if you have those three things, you are 50% to anywhere you want to go. Now, you know, once you have those, you want to actually create change. And in order to create change, all you need is a very simple mantra. And it's called the three C's. They are constant, conscious, choices. There's the cool thing about constant conscious choices is that you already understand them. I'll give you an example. Let's say I want to get a six-pack abs. I make a choice. I choose to get six-pack abs. Ripped. Doesn't work like that. We all know that. We need to make a conscious choice. What's a conscious choice? A conscious choice is understanding your intrinsic drivers, understanding the real reasons for making it. Now, I choose to get a six pack so that I'm ripped for the beach this summer to get all the ladies. No, it's an extrinsic reason and they don't end up working. I choose consciously to work on my body right now because I just turned 40 years old and I can't even get close to touching my toes. I've basically neglected my body for 40 years and I need to work on it in order to be able to carry this thing around for another 40 years. And so I have a very good intrinsic driver to make a conscious choice to get ripped. But I'm still not ripped. You see, I'll tell you my gym routine. So what I do is I go to the gym for probably, 12 to 17 minutes a week. And I eat clean about 5% of the time. That's because I fall down on the same thing that most of us fall down, the constant. I want to get ripped. I need to be making constant conscious choices. So that means that I need to, every time I eat, I need to make a choice of the sugar or the good stuff. I need to go, should I watch TV or should I go work out? I need to make constant choices over a considerable period of time in order to get the result. And exactly the same thing works in your head. I'll give you an example of something in the head. So I verbally jab my wife. I have a new wife now, way better than the last one. Thanks for asking. I verbally jab my wife. And so in New Zealand parlance, basically that means I take the piss. Little quick-witted jabs. Now, they're not horrible, but they're not nice either. And my wife wanted me to stop that. And so I went, okay, I'll figure that out. And so I did make a concerted effort. And so I came up with this little system for myself and it was very simple, which was every time I took the piss out of her, I would be aware of it, step one. And if I was not aware of it, she had permission to make me aware of it and she did. Step two, apologize to my wife, take radical ownership of the behavior that I had done. And then step three was very simple, but most important step was I would stand there for a second or two and I would close my eyes and I would look inside and I would imagine that behavior like a little black ball inside of me. And I would say, I do not choose this. I do not choose this behavior. I choose love instead. And so for math's sake, let's say I jabbed her once a day. So 7 days in a week, week one, 7 days, seven jabs. Week two, 7 days, seven jabs. Week four, 7 days, five jabs. Oh, okay. Week eight, 7 days, no jabs. And what I had done was change something that was just inherently me, something that I had since I was a child, something that was part of my personality. I changed that. And I was like, holy shit, you're a genius. You've come up with something that's going to change the world. Turns out, someone had thought of it before me, and it's called neuroplasticity. It's basically what I regard as the greatest discovery of the 20th century, that our brains are malleable, that we can rewire our brains. Now, neuroplasticity, crazy, complicated, insane topic, but brilliantly interesting. Basically, we send neurons down neural pathways for every thought. The more we think about, the more thoughts we send down particular pathways, the stronger they get. The less we send them down, the weaker they get. And so that's all I'd been doing. I'd been sending the thoughts down the neural pathways of the not taking the piss pathway, and that was getting stronger. And I was sending less down the take the piss pathway, and it was getting weaker. And then basically, the stronger one ends up becoming your default pathway. And so I just started not taking the piss. And I was like, holy shit, this is brilliant. I'm going to now start applying this to everything. And so I started looking at all the things on my list and a whole bunch of other things. And I was like, right. And it's kind of like going to the gym in my head. And I would just pick an exercise and I would aim at fixing that one. And I'd spend a couple of months on it. And then at the end, boom, it changed. And so over the next 9 months, I changed what I'll make this number up, about 70% of my personality. I changed about 70% of who I was in about 9 months. And I mean, that sounds quite crazy, but I've literally got a wife, family, and friends to back that up. I became more empathetic, more loving, more caring, more compassionate. I had more patience. I had all of these things I worked on in order to counteract a bunch of the other things. I was like, this is brilliant. Now, understand this. Moving up the mental fitness continuum I can't see my next slide, so I'll just keep going. Now, so what I really wanted to do is understand that moving up the mental fitness continuum is a lifetime game. It does not go away, just like your physical fitness doesn't. But see, the key is to make the effort to do just the constant conscious choices consistently over time. And so for me, I just wanted to be 1% better every day. That's it. Just a little bit better every day. And you see, it's so easy for us as humans to overestimate the importance of one defining moment and underestimate the value of small improvements on a daily basis. See, too often we convince ourselves that massive success, massive change requires massive action. But it doesn't. You can't teleport up the continuum. There's nothing you can do that will just magically gain you 20 or 30 points. Just like you can't go to the gym and bench press 50% more than you did yesterday. It just doesn't work like that. And so what we're really looking for is the aggregation of marginal gains. And here's how the math works out. If you try and get 1% better every day for a year, which is 1 to the 0.01 to the power of 365, it's not 3.65 times better at the end of the year, it's 37.78. It's that compound interest stuff that we don't learn at school. Now, this math was, I saw for the first time, in a book called Atomic Habits by James Clear, one of the best books I read in regards to how we can put things in place in order to help change our habits, and I highly recommend it. Like chapter one, I think even maybe, of this book, he tells the story of the English cycling team, and they sucked. They hadn't won any gold medals. They hadn't won any Tour de France titles or anything like that. And a new coach came in with this theory of the aggregation of marginal gains. And basically, he started looking at the bikes and going, how can we make these 1% lighter? He started looking at the clothes. How do we make them 1% more aerodynamic? And then he started looking, how do we make them recover 1% faster? How do we make them sleep 1% better? And he put these guys in a lab and tested all the sleeping conditions, the pillows, the mattresses, to find out how to get them to sleep 1% better. And then they literally took the mattresses and the pillows and the conditions with them on tour so that these guys could get 1% better sleep. 3 years later, they ended up winning 60% of the gold medals available at the next games. And then they started winning Tour de France titles and stages. That is the power of small continuous gains over time, the aggregation of marginal gains. This is the thing. I kind of tell people that I'm like a personal trainer for your mind. I can't do the work for you, but I can give you the workout plan so that you can do the work for yourself. Look, this is my favorite quote in the entire world. Well, this is my favorite quote in the entire world. You cannot overestimate the unimportance of practically everything. Practically everything is unimportant in the grand scheme of things. Basically, you know, the sports score, the car you drive, your job, your husband, your wife, practically unimportant in the grand scheme of things. And so if the answer to the question is, well, what is important to me? Very simple. You are the most important. You are more important than the sports score, the car you drive, more important than the job you have, your husband, your wife. You're more important than your children. I said that to 400 kindy mums. Whew, laser eyes at me. And I got this, my first and only heckle at a talk. And this woman said, Jimmy, that's selfish. And I said, no, the definition of selfish is to put yourself first to the detriment of others. And I'm not asking you to do that. I'm asking you to put yourself first for the benefit of others. I'm asking you to put yourself first. Move yourself up the continuum so you're better at your job. You're more effective. You're more efficient. You come up with better ideas. You work better on a team. I'm asking you to put yourself first. Move yourself up the continuum so you are a better lover. You have less fights. I'm asking you to put yourself first. Move yourself up the continuum so that you are a better parent. It's far better having two people at 30 raise their children than two people at 70. Sorry, other way around. Two people at 70 and two people at 30. You know what I mean. You have to understand that TV can't do it for you. Movies can't do it for you. Books, talks like this, they can't do it for you. Only you can do the work in your head. Only you can take the knowledge and turn it into action and use that action to use constant conscious choices consistently over time to move yourself up the mental fitness continuum. Look, we're in a bad state as society and as individuals. The stats show that. So we have to ask ourselves some very serious questions. Where are we on the mental fitness continuum? Do we have enough tools to be able to move ourselves up or deal with anything that comes along? And when are we going to draw the line in the sand to start making constant, conscious choices consistently over time to move ourselves up to be happier, healthier, more resilient for ourselves and for everyone else around us? Thanks, everyone.